Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday, December 3rd. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun show on the way for you today. It is the Monday Overreactions Podcast, and I want to dive deep into one big overreaction that I have, and that is that Michigan might actually be the best team in college basketball. So I brought on the man that knows Michigan better than anybody that is not inside that program. His name is Brendan Quinn. He is a staff writer for The Athletic. He covers Michigan. He covers Michigan State. He hosts the podcast called The Moving Screen about Michigan and Michigan State. We had a nice long conversation about the Wolverines, the Big Ten in general, and some a little bit of a rant by me about this year's Player of the Year race. So before I get into all of that, I have to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast. Any interaction that you have with this podcast and the apps that you listen to podcasts in, it really does help us. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. It makes my bosses happy. And when my boss is happy, I'm happy. And when I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So if you could throw me 5 stars, if you could say something nice about me, I would appreciate it. You are just doing yourself a favor. Now let's get into that conversation with Brendan Quinn. And now let me welcome on Brendan Quinn, who is the Michigan and Michigan State beat writer for The Athletic, and he is the host of the Moving Screen podcast, along with Dylan Burkhart, who you can find him on Twitter at UMHoops. He is not here. I just have Brendan. Fair warning to everyone listening. Brendan is currently on his way to East Lansing to go cover the Michigan State-Iowa game tonight. So if you hear any random cursing in the background, nothing to be worried about. That's just the Philly coming out of him. So, Brendan, I appreciate the time, and I hope you don't get an accident on this drive.
No, we're good. We got a little bit of some flurries that are always makes it exciting to go back and forth between Ann Arbor and East Lansing. But I am I could pretty much do this drive blindfolded at this point. So
you live in Ann Arbor, and you make the drive up to East Lansing, right?
Correct. My first job was at MLive here, and it was Michigan-centric. I only covered Michigan, so I got a place in Ann Arbor. And then Michigan State was added to my beat while I was at MLive, and I just kept it. I just, you know, stayed in Ann Arbor. It's a good city to live in, so, you know, no reason to mess with that. So.
And moving is the worst thing on the planet. There's nothing that I like less than having to pack all of my stuff up and put all of it in a truck, move it to a different place, and then unpack all of it. If I never move again, it'll be perfect. I don't want to move. I hate moving.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure if I pack up my car one more time, there's only one place I'm going, and it's Philadelphia. So I'm not moving to another non-Philadelphia city. So,
all right. So the reason I have you on here, other than to just sing the praises of the city of Philadelphia, is that I need to talk about Michigan because they are awesome, and it kind of came out of nowhere, as everybody on my Twitter feed is going to remind me. I had them ranked 23rd in the preseason. At the very end of last year's tournament, the first time I did preseason rankings, I did not have them in the top 25. My Twitter mentions have been nothing but a flood of angry people with that little M emoji in their Twitter handle telling me about how dumb I am and how wrong I am and how angry they are about it. So, Brendan, why is Michigan awesome? I'm going to leave this one open-ended for you. Tell me about it.
Well, I think – so here's the really, really simple version. They got 4 guys, maybe 5 guys, you can make an argument, who can put 20 on you on any given night. No one in the locker room cares who it is. That's the first part of the secret sauce. And then the other thing is on the defensive side of the ball, they do the most basic thing extraordinarily well. And that is just stay in front of your man. When talking to guys from North Carolina last week, that's what every single guy touched on. They're just like, they just stay in front of you. They're always right there. And that's obviously that's the basic version. And now the reason of why they are able to do that is extremely important. It's much more complicated. You know, they come up with game-specific plans on switching ball screens that is devised by Luke Jaklich. Every guy knows his job, and every guy executes his job. They know their assignments. They know their matchups. They are as well-prepared as any team in the country. And you know, they got a bunch of athletes who move their feet and know what they're doing on defense. And then you got John Teske back there as an anchor, giving Michigan a shot blocking presence that it never has had under John Beilein. And there you have it. You know, it's crazy. I made the point in a story about John Teske this weekend that it's a real conversation that you could say, would Michigan be better or worse if Mo Wagner had returned for his senior year? And that is just ludicrous that, you know, and you can make a case either way. That's beside the point. But it's ludicrous that that's even a conversation. Crazy. So, yeah, they are a little bit out of nowhere. I had them, like, I think second in my preseason Big Ten team. I felt that they could be a second weekend team this year. I did not see them as a national championship contender, which they very clearly are.
Yeah, and in my Monday overreactions column that I wrote today, I said more or less that Michigan deserves to be right there with Gonzaga and Duke, and I guess maybe even Kansas, if you want to throw them in there, as the potential number one teams in the country and potentially the best team in all of college basketball. But I do want to talk about John Teske for a second, because I know I didn't read it yet. I saw you tweet it out earlier. You had a story about him. Like, where the hell did this come from? Last year we were laughing about how, like, this guy that's kind of a bum came in and had like 13 points against Michigan in the was that the Big Ten tournament semifinal or whatever it was. And now all of a sudden
that was
against, like,
Purdue. Yeah.
Oh, it was a whatever it was. He came out of nowhere in the Big Ten tournament, had this monster game. Everybody's talking about how this bum is awesome all of a sudden. And now he comes out here this year and he's like switching ball screens and blocking everybody at the rim and catching oops and hitting threes on people. Like, who the hell is this kid and what got into him? Mm-hmm.
So he's a the interesting thing about John, and part of what the story I wrote is that, you know, he's not one of these 7-footers who like in the span of, you know, one calendar year went from 6'3" to 7 foot. He more so, like, he had one long growth spurt from about 6'2" to like 6'7", from like the beginning of his 7th grade year to like the end of his 8th. So, you know, kind of drawn out, but point being is he literally is a guy who kind of grew like an inch or two at a time and just got big, and as a result has never really been awkward or gangly. Like, even when he was in high school, yeah, he was thin, but like he had tree trunk legs. He was never like skinny. He's always been a big guy. Like, he came into Michigan at 245. So point being is he is comfortable in his body, and he's got good footwork, and he's got good hands, and he can do all these things, and he can shoot. Beilein would always say, like, he can shoot, you just haven't seen it. And lo and behold, he just bangs 2 threes the other day against Purdue. And, you know, you're sitting there as a Matt Painter, and you're trying to game plan against Michigan offensively. And so you're thinking, okay, Charles Matthews back to the basket game. We got to make sure we got 2 feet beyond the arc on Jordan Poole. You got to make sure, you know, you're staying in front of Ignas Brazdeikis and not letting him get downhill. And then lo and behold, John Teske comes out and hits you with 17 points and you just kind of throw your hands up and, you know, you're screwed. So, where did he come from? He's an Ohio kid. He did have a scholarship offer from Ohio State and turned it down to go to Michigan, but he had some decent looks, you know, Xavier and the like. But he just kind of had the good fortune of being able to sit behind Mo Wagner for 2 years and develop physically and get better and see what the offense looks like with a stretch five and know that, you know, if he's going to play big minutes, that's what he needs to be. He can't just be a on the block, back to the basket guy. And this is how Beilein recruited him. You know, he can hit that 15-foot baseline shot. He can hit the straight on three. He's just now getting better at reading ball screens offensively and defensively. I think when to pop and when to roll is something that is still kind of a work in progress, and defensively, you know, when to step out and make sure you're guarding that guy, or, you know, just hedging properly, all these things. It's coming with time, though, but, you know, he's a good basketball player, and he's given them a lot. The fact that he can – the most impressive thing right now is that he can play 31 or 34 minutes, which he did the last week. Like, that's the crazy part, too, all of us who are around the program. The fact that he even has the endurance to do that is really impressive. It's a testament to Michigan's strength and conditioning program.
Now, you were with this team in Barcelona when they took their preseason trip in August, which, like, one, tough life you lead there, Brendan, having to go to Barcelona to watch basketball games.
Yes, sir.
You know, I really feel bad about you there. But did you – so they lost 2 games out there, if I'm not mistaken. I know they lost to the team Mega B-Max. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but they lost to the team that beat Kentucky by 36 points or that Kentucky beat by 36 points in the Bahamas. So I guess what my question is, like, did you see this coming from them? Like, where, what is different now versus what you saw in August when they were losing the teams that they probably shouldn't be losing to?
Yeah, so for the record, they were bad. They were bad in Spain. I didn't see this coming at all. They had some glaring issues coming out of that trip. You're right, they went 1-2. They went something like 10 for 44 or something like that on threes. They didn't look like, no one looked like they really knew what they were doing. Everyone was just trying to attack the basket and score. No one really knew how to distribute the ball. They were content in thinking that they could shoot threes, which they couldn't. The defense was getting there, but even talking with Luke Jokic, like on times of that trip, like some downtime, we're just sitting there and he's like, man, you know, I got guys who I can communicate through, but you know, we're still growing a lot there and blah, blah, blah. You know, they knew that the defense was going to be a strength based, you know, solely on the fact that you'd have Teske playing more minutes, than with Wagner moving on. But then also have Xavier Simpson and Charles Matthews, two of the best defensive players in the league. But offensively, they were all over the place. They were a mess. And now you'll remember they also didn't have John Beilein on that trip. It was soon after he had open heart surgery, and he was back home recovering. So the assistants were coaching, and the players, they didn't look that good. And, you know, there's a reason that I didn't pick them to win the league. The team that I saw in Spain was not going to win the Big Ten. And, well, what the hell do I know? Because they're really, really, really good now. And I think this team, you know, the old cliche at this time of year, we all write about, like, this team is developing their roles, right? That's the big, like, buzzword, especially in November and December, everyone finding their roles and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, it is a cliche, but it's also not a cliche. And this year's team is, like, the perfect example of a group that I've never been around a team that everyone just knows what their job is and is comfortable with it and is happy with it. And yes, they could probably have a little bit more depth. They're basically playing a tight 7-man rotation. But the roles that have developed and what this group does and how they play together is at an extremely high level for this time of the year.
I've always thought that depth has always been a little bit overrated in college basketball. I mean, yeah. It's nice to have extra bodies just in case, you know, somebody sprains an ankle. Or, you know, you have someone that ends up having to go out for a month, like a broken foot or a broken hand, or those things that happen all the time in basketball. But you don't really need more than seven guys in a basketball mm-hmm. game. Like, maybe insurance for foul trouble, whatever. But it's mostly – there's a reason why teams like Villanova have always kind of limited the number of scholarship players they have and redshirted some guys. And part of it is so that players aren't getting – necessarily unhappy, right? Like, Jay Wright doesn't really want more than 7-8 guys that he's going to play in a rotation, because if you have more people expecting more minutes, that's how people get upset and blah 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 blah. So
yeah,
I don't know if that's necessarily a concern, but I do think your point about, like, the players accepting their roles is interesting with this group, because the you mentioned it earlier, the thing about them is it doesn't seem like anybody cares who the best player is, and it kind of puts it in a tough mm-hmm. position when we're talking about, like, who's the All-American from this group? Who is their player of the year? Who's their MVP? Right. Like, it makes it tough. Like, I have to do a player of the year power ranking tomorrow, and I know there's going to be no one from Michigan on that list.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty telling on my on the podcast today, recording it with Dylan. I just kind of threw it out there. I'm like, you know, who's this team's MVP right now? And Dylan, it was like 10 seconds of silence as he's trying to figure out who you – and the answer is there's no answer. Because while statistically you see what Xavier Simpson is and he's not going to jump off the page at you, you could – like, that guy's one of the most important players in the country. For what he does for Michigan and the identity that he gives them, like, everyone feeds off his energy. And, you know, he's one of the most interesting people you'll come across, and he's just crazy, and he's wired like no one else that I've been around. And, you know, so I don't really care what his numbers are or what his efficiency ratings are. You know what I mean? Like, he is invaluable. And Charles Matthews gives them so much on both ends of the floor, and just basically locks up whoever you put on him or whoever you put him on defensively. And then, you know, Poole can put 25 on you. And Iggy Brazdeikis is probably the most underrated freshman in the country. They just got guys all over the place. So you're right. And the interesting thing with the seven-man rotation is, you know, it's just that injury. It's just what happens if or when. Because the guys that they have their next flight are completely inexperienced. And anytime I've seen the other freshmen on the court, they're just lost. They're just looking at the bench, either looking to be told what to do or looking to be told that they're getting taken out. You know, you got a guy there in Brandon Johns who, if you watch him go through warmups, you're like, well, that guy's going to be in the NBA. My God, right? And then on the floor, though, he doesn't know what he's doing, and he kind of lacks some lateral quickness that makes him maybe a bit of a deficiency defensively. But he has all of the pieces to be a high-level college basketball player, and you're like, you'd just like to maybe have him as an option if someone on that front line goes down, or even like someone like Isaiah Livers, who just gives them so much. Like if he goes down, you're missing a huge piece, even though he's like the fifth or sixth leading scorer on the team.
Yeah, and I think you can make the argument for like probably four guys being the MVP of that team, right? I think. What Xavier? You touched on everything with Xavier Simpson. Like he's I think it's fair to say he's the heart and soul of everything that they do. And I think he's kind of the head of the snake when it comes to you know, what makes their defense so tough and so effective. But I also think that what John Teske provides in terms of, you know, what he's become defensively, and the fact that he's now a guy, like he's a lob target in pick and roll situations, and he's a guy that can make threes when you go pick and pop, I think that's incredibly valuable for the way that John Beilein wants to run his offense. I think that Iggy Brazdeikis is just like what he's able to do at the four spot, how tough he is, how physical he is. The fact that he's shooting, 43% from three, and he's out there scoring like 16 points a game. He can grab and go if he gets a defensive rebound. Like that is so important to what they do. He provides a lineup versatility. And then Charles Matthews, like, what can you really say? You have a guy that's a 6'6", like tough physical defender that like, man, he's good enough to be an NBA defender on the wing, and you're going to be able to put him on like any score that you have. It's just all four of those guys, I think you can make an argument, are the most important, maybe the most valuable player on the team. And when you have four dudes like that and none of them actually care like who gets the credit or the rewards as long as they're winning, I mean, that's the dream, right? That's the perfect scenario.
Yeah, and there's stuff that's even like the unexpected improvements that I certainly didn't see coming. Like Jordan Poole's defense, like Jordan Poole plays defense, which is, in and of itself, a funny sentence. Like he could not have possibly cared less defensively last year. And now, like, is he a lockdown guy? No, but he's not a total liability. He plays the same level of defense. It's not that it was supposed to be an enormous drop off from Muhammad Ali Abdur-Rahman to him. And it hasn't been. And, yeah, like, Ignas Brazdeikis' three-point shooting, he didn't even take a three in three games in Spain. Didn't attempt one. And now here he is. He's a total threat, which means, like, if you have to step out on him, his ability to go by you and bully past you and go to the basket all day, the fact that he keeps defenders honest is huge. So they've got, like, all these little unexpected things, too, that have really kind of mixed all together and put the team in position. And then just to touch on Xavier Simpson for one more second, like last week he shut down Carson Edwards and Kobe White back-to-back. I don't know many guys in college basketball who can do that. And the fact that the defense gets the opposing point guard or top scorer just shut down every single game, we talk about Luke Jokić all day for how good of a defensive coach he is, but you know, Luke will also point to Xavier Simpson and Charles Matthews and say, well, when you got guys like that, like you're going to be a good defensive coach. So, you know, those guys care about every single defensive possession. Like they will celebrate. This is a team, for as good as it is, they still celebrate stops more than they do scores. And when you get guys thinking that way, like you're going to be a really, really good team.
Now, what's your sense on why Beilein decided to make the hire of Luke Jokić? I can see it two different ways. One, I can see where he saw a leak in his coaching, right? He basically said, look, I'm a guy, I love offense, I'm obsessed with offense. Every time we go back on defense, I'm thinking about what we're going to do on the next offensive possession. Like, this is my blind spot. I need to find someone to fill that hole. Or was it a situation where he kind of saw what he had coming in the pipeline? And he was like, well, you know, we're not going to have these great offensive players. Like Xavier Simpson is not Trey Burke. Charles Matthews is not Nick Stauskas. You know, John Teske is not Mo Wagner. Maybe I need to go out and hire somebody that will be able to figure out what to do with these guys on the defensive end of the floor. Like, is that, or was it a combination of all of the above? Like, what's your sense on why that decision was made? Because I can't think of another situation where there's like a specific defensive coordinator on any coaching staff at any level of basketball.
Yeah. So this actually all goes back to the original staff turnover. Beeline staff of Bakari Alexander, Laval Jordan, and Jeff Meyer was intact for, I think, 6 years running. So when there was turnover originally on that, with Bakari Alexander getting the Detroit Mercy job and Laval getting the Milwaukee job, John just went back and started like kind of rethinking about how he uses his staff and how who does what and what the breakdown is. And he had the idea that he wanted someone to focus on defense. And he hired Billy Donlin, who was then fired at Wright State. And Billy is a defensive guy. And that was the first year of it. And basically what John wanted, the way it was explained to me, is that he realized one of the parts of his coaching is that when an opposing team takes a – or I'm sorry, when Michigan like gets going in offense, John's mind is only on offense. And when they miss a shot on the offensive end, he's still thinking about the missed shot as the transition is going in the other way. And what he wanted was someone on his bench that is only worrying about defense, so that when that ball – is missed and the other team's going the other way, someone is on that bench shouting out assignments and coaching defense in real time that the players would literally see as being a head coach for defense. That's what he wanted. And that's why he hired Billy Donlin. And now Billy left after a year and went to Northwestern. But then he wanted to make another defensive hire. He liked how it worked out. And Dan Muller recommended Luke Jaklich to Beilein as a defensive guy, and the two met, and they are very similar people. They're both former high school teachers. They're both geeks, for lack of a better term, when it comes to basketball, and both would admit it. And they hit it off. They very much speak the same language and think similarly and are very neurotic about the game and watching film. So they clicked, and as you'll remember, that was one of two hires that John made off that staff, but he also brought in DeAndre, and you know that's how he filled out his staff with two assistants from Illinois State who no one had ever heard of. It was like the most Beilein move ever to hire, you know, two guys off a mid-major staff that like had like very little pedigree to them, and lo and behold, you know, compile this staff that now has, you know, all this, everyone writes so glowingly about them and talks about them so much. And you know, John, for everyone trying to figure out, you know, why he does the way things he does and how he actually operates, like, I feel like as these later years in his life, one of the biggest attributes he has is an amazing level of self-awareness and understanding of what he can do and what he can't do, and being comfortable divvying out, you know, responsibilities and then letting those guys do their thing without looking over their shoulder, which I think he did a lot on previous staffs. And now he's still as hands-on as anyone you'll get, but I think he just lets guys do their jobs. And, you know, everyone's really taking advantage of it. It's a really good, they have a really good situation there overall.
Yeah. And it might end up getting them a national title. Real quick, before I kind of bounce around the Big Ten a little bit with you, I need to go on a rant, and you're going to have to deal with me while I kind of go on this rant, because we talked about the player of the year stuff and how difficult it is to pick somebody out for Michigan, right? Well, it's just that difficult to pick out like a national player of the year, because if you look at some of these teams at the top, like generally speaking, what we do is we'll look and say, okay, this is the best player on a team that's going to end up being like a top three or four seed. That's basically what it comes down to when you are picking like a national player of the year in college basketball. I went back and I looked at it and I figured out the numbers. And if you're not the best player on a national title contender, you are Kevin Durant on a 4 seed or Doug McDermott on a 4 seed
mm-hmm.
or somebody, or Jimmer Fredette, just somebody having an outlier season on a top 4 seed. So there's nobody like that this year. But then if you look at the best teams, you can't really parse through like who is the best player on that team. Like Michigan, I don't even know if they have a player of the year on their team, let alone a national player of the year. Duke, are you going to go Zion or RJ Barrett? You go to Gonzaga, I mean, it could be Rui Hachimura, but Josh Perkins just had 13 points and 13 assists in a comeback road win against Creighton. You know, Brandon Clark has been a defensive revelation for him. Zach Norvell has been the leading scorer. Like, he had 22 in the second half in that game against Creighton. You go to Kansas, and Dedrick Lawson is, like, putting up these great numbers. But LeGerald Vick is the guy that's going out and dropping 30 every time it looks like Kansas is going to end up losing a home game. So you can't really pick someone right there. You know, it could be DeAndre Hunter at Virginia. But if you talk to people around that program, they'll tell you that Ty Jerome is the guy that's probably their most valuable player between his leadership and the fact that he could play point guard and off the ball and all these other different things. So it's just, I have to do these rankings every Tuesday. And I come down to it, I'm like, there's all these guys that are really good picks for first-team All-Americans, but there's not one player that is like a national player of the year, and it drives me crazy, and then I have to end up ranking people fifth that I could think are first, and it's just that these are the stresses of my life, Brendan. This is what kind of gets to me, and this is what I get mad about. So, I don't know. I just had to get that rant out, and I just had to say it.
Do we have the option of not having to pick a national player of the year in December?
I like doing these rankings because here's the thing. Like,
it doesn't sound like you do.
No, normally I do because like the last 3 or 4 years, somebody stepped up. Like Frank Mason, from the first time that I did this, the year that he won it in 2017, it was obvious that it was going to be him. Like, he was the guy from the get-go. Last year, Trae Young jumped out immediately, and then it was Jalen Brunson that came up after him. Like, it was very clear who the leader was the whole time. In 2016, the year that Buddy Hield won it, like, he jumped out right away and was the very clear, obvious favorite until Denzel Valentine came up and kind of took things over. But even Denzel, if you'll remember, I don't know if you were covering Michigan State then, but in that Champions Classic, he had 29 points, 12 boards, and 12 assists. So he was right there as a front runner from the beginning. So it's always been very obvious, like, who the favorite is or who the two favorites are. The year before that, it was Jahlil Okafor and Frank Kaminsky. And that started from, like day one of the season. And this year, there's, like, 9 or 10 guys that you can make a very legitimate argument for being National Player of the Year. And I guess that's fun, but it just kind of, like, it makes me have to think. And normally I don't have to think when I do these rankings. And my Tuesdays are much easier. It really is all about me.
I picked Rui as my preseason National Player of the Year. So I'll ride and die with him.
Yeah, well, it's looking pretty good at this point.
Yeah, man, it sounds like you're in a pickle.
I am. It's tough. It's tough being robbed sometimes. All right, let's bounce around the Big Ten a little bit. I have some hot takes for you. First one, Michigan State has absolutely nothing to worry about, even though they just lost at Louisville. Fair or not?
I wouldn't say that now, but here's the problem. When you do the beat writer interviews, right, the guy who watches every single game, you're like, you only see the flaws, right? I'm not sure what to make of Michigan State. I think the levels of concern regarding their turnovers and the fact that, like, I've always been so high on Cassius Winston, and I still am, but it's just, like, kind of waiting for him to be the guy. They're still waiting, and I know the staff up there is still kind of just waiting for him to – he fouled out of a game at Louisville with his backup point guard at home injured and a freshman who's not ready to play behind him. He decided to commit a bad foul at the end of the first half and a bad foul at the beginning of the second half and ends up fouling out of the game with the starting point guard.
It was so dumb. What was he doing?
Dylan pointed out on the podcast he didn't have one defensive rebound in that game, and he fouled out going for a defensive rebound. You're like, you don't need that from you. Like, you know, it's just, you're just kind of waiting for him to be a superstar. And Josh Langford is trying to do everything under the sun right now. And he's trying to do so much that it's a detriment to him. So, yeah, I mean, I still think, look, Michigan State's still a contender in the Big Ten. I think it's still a second weekend NCAA tournament team. but there's just waiting for the turnovers to get cut out and waiting for some of these guys to kind of come around. And Matt McQuaid still isn't back. He's going to miss tonight's game against Iowa, and they do need him. They do. He gives them a lot. And I would not say that there's zero concerns at Michigan State, but you're probably asking the wrong guy on that question.
Well, here's why I say it. It's because we thought that heading into the season they were going to be like a 3-seed, a 4-seed, second weekend kind of team, right? We thought that they looked like the favorite in the Big Ten because we didn't know if there was actually going to be anyone that was really all that good in the Big Ten. We knew that they were a team that had question marks entering the season, and I guess I'm sitting here in the same place where losing in overtime in a game where your point guard does something dumb to force like a freshman that's played like 40 minutes all season long has to come in and play an overtime of a road game against a good Louisville team. Nothing that they've done has made me think that they're any worse than what I thought they were entering the season. I guess that's what my point is. And I think that part of the reason people are freaking out is because they're like, oh, wow, Michigan's a juggernaut, so now Michigan State is going to be little brother once again. And I think that that is probably playing a role in some of the freakout. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, you're spot on the whole Michigan thing, and it's obviously the frustrating part of doing both is that everything is viewed through the lens of the other, and – you know, it's like, how about we just separate the two and have two separate conversations, which, you know, I try to do, but people
it's don't not possible. Especially so, not when your podcast, I don't know if people, you guys got to go find it on iTunes and see the logo. Half of it is Michigan colors and half of it is Michigan State colors. So it's almost like the whole podcast is pitting the two programs against each other.
You know, well, we're not going to have separate podcasts, for God's sake. That'd be ridiculous. So I don't have time for that.
All right, so you had a chance to see Purdue up close. I'm really worried about the fact that they are Carson Edwards and not much else. What do you make of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, their best offense is Carson Edwards running around taking contested jumpers and trying to do everything. Either that or, you know, if he can get Ryan Klein for a wide open three, that works too. But really, there's very little else. And their defense is non-existent, really. They tried to switch everything against Michigan, and it did not go well. But, yeah, I think they have some defensive deficiencies. Carson Edwards is really good, but he's trying to do everything, and it's impossible. I was not particularly high on Purdue coming into the year. I just think they lost too much, which is obviously proving to be right because they did lose a lot. I never understood why. I saw him in the preseason top 15 and top 20, and I'm like, Carson Edwards is really good, but, like, I don't know if he's enough to just throw an entire team on his back. Like, they just don't have that much. So I think they'll be better in February than they are now, but they're just not very good right now.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, they're going to be good enough, or Carson Edwards is going to be good enough where he'll lead them to a couple wins they probably shouldn't get just because he'll go for, like, 40 and go crazy one night. But –
right.
For the most part, like they're like a 500 team, 10-8 kind of team in the Big Ten, I think.
I agree. And don't forget, they're playing 20 games now, so it'd be
11-10. Yeah, whatever it is, they're like 500. That's a lot of math, right. Brendan. That's a lot of math. I think Wisconsin is really, really, really good. Am I crazy?
No. I'm high on the Badgers. Ethan Happ is playing as expected. Dimitri Trice might just probably given him more than people had anticipated. He's been great. And then Brad Davidson's flopping and flailing all over the place and getting dubs and getting stops. So, I like the makeup. They're another team that knows what they're doing, right? Everyone knows the assignment. A lot of guys who are back. You know, you're not learning on the fly anymore. And I mean, Happ is just so good. He just, all the stuff that he does, like these, one of my favorite plays in college basketball right now is the post up capped kick out from Happ, where he gets someone on his back. They flip down a little lob entry pass to him. He just catches it in one hand and then rifles it to the other side of the court with that hand for a kick out three. It's just beautiful. So, he's great. Very much a contender for conference player of the year. I don't know if he's in your conversation.
Yes, he is.
National player of the year.
I have him top five.
He's been great.
I have him top five for National Player of the Year right now. Like, I think he has a, if Michigan ends up being a team, like, if they can keep playing this way and, like, the win over NC State wasn't a fluke and Iowa actually ends up being good and winning at Iowa doesn't just mean that you're, like, not horrible, then I think that he's going to be very much in that conversation. Demetric Trice, too. Like, I don't think he's missed a shot this year. Him and Jordan Poole, like, I feel like in the last 2 weeks, neither of them have actually missed a shot.
and not even rattling them in. They're just pure, you know, everything is pure. That goes up. And I'm all in for Michigan, Wisconsin, and Michigan State, Wisconsin, and seeing those three beat the hell out of each other. That's gonna be good hoop.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun, man. All right, so the last one I got for you is Ohio State, Nebraska, Iowa, and Maryland. Are you buying into any of those teams?
I'll take Nebraska. Some impressive stuff, and they defend, and they got multiple guys who can score. Palmer is still sneaky. No one talks about him, but he's really, really good. He's one of these guys that it's like, sorry you're at Nebraska, because you'd be getting a lot more hype if you were at pretty much anywhere else. The thing with Nebraska is everyone knew that they had guys who could score. I don't know if anyone thought they were going to play quite this level of defense. They're really, really guarding the ball. So I think they are a contender. I don't know if they win the league. Obviously, Michigan is clearly the far and ahead favorite for that. But, I think they're a team that can make some noise come bracket. So Maryland, pass. Ohio State, they are one of the most well-coached teams in the country. Every time I watch them, Holtman just blows me away how good he is. So I'll buy them as a probably outperform preseason expectations and do some good stuff. And who was the last one you said?
Iowa.
Can you ask me tomorrow?
Yeah, just
I kind of want to see them play Michigan State tonight. I'm not sure what to make of Iowa. They are at least playing some defense this year compared to the non-defense that they played last year, so that's good. But I just don't know how good they are. I need to see them play some better teams. And they got those nice wins in New York early season. That was huge for the league to get that momentum. I'm not ready to say that they're an NCAA tournament team. I think I'll have a better idea of seeing them firsthand up at Breslin. I'm not saying they need to win the game, but I just want to see how good they are. You know, Tyler Cook's a bad man. He looks a lot quicker to me this year. I don't know if you have seen that, but he's always been super athletic and big and strong. He's just like, he's made some hiccup quick plays this year where I'm like, man, he's just a bad dude. So,
I didn't realize he could play on the perimeter the way that he has been. Like, he's out there handling the ball, crossing people up. I didn't realize he had that in his game. He also, like, he might be the most intimidating dude in college basketball because, like, he's got these big old eyes, and he gets this look, and he just stares at people, and he legitimately looks like he is a crazy person when he's playing out there, and, like, he's dunking on you. I saw them when they were in New York, and I was sitting courtside, and I was legitimately terrified.
Yeah, I would like to see maybe Tyler Cook versus Xavier Simpson in a rock fight or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Two crazy people just going at it. He's a bad man. So he goes against Nick Ward in this game, and that's good. That's good viewing right there for you and the people out there if anyone wants to watch some Big Ten hoops tonight.
Yeah, I don't – for the record, I don't disagree with any of your takes. Chris Holtman at Ohio State, I don't know how he does it, man. Every time I see them play, I'm like, why are they in this game? Why are they winning this game? How are they winning this game? And then they end up winning by like 10 or 12 points. So they went into Creighton and won. Creighton's good, and they went into Creighton and won. It's, you know, good for Holtman, man.
Yeah, and it's good for – good for the league. I think, you know, you want Ohio State. That's a team that just needs to be relevant.
Yes, I agree with you there. It's good when the Big Ten is as good as it is this year. We have a lot of we have less angry fan bases around, even though Michigan fans are still yelling at me on Twitter.
I need your take on something as a national guy, right?
Give it to me.
I've been very curious to see. So the league has played really well in non-conference. I think most people would agree. And I've been curious. They've got this 20-game schedule now, and I do think that the league, like, I think they're all just going to beat the hell out of each other, and that there's a really good chance that you have, like, nine teams at, like, 11-9 to 9-11 overall. And I'm not sure what the committee does with that. If you get, you know, if you have nine teams in the league that have 10-ish conference wins, what do they do?
I think that they are probably going to end up getting like 9 or 10 teams in. And it depends on, for me, at this point, I think it kind of depends on like what Maryland ends up being and what Minnesota ends up being. You know, I think Minnesota might not actually be good. So probably 9 is what I would say right now. And that kind of depends. Like, I think Iowa and Maryland are going to end up being the bubble teams, and they'll be team 8 and team 9 into the tournament. And that's just because, you know, one, the Big Ten has done a really good job of getting wins during non-conference play, right? Like, every time you turn around, they're beating somebody else, and they're beating another ranked team, and they came out looking really good in the ACC Big Ten Challenge. But the other part of it is, like, the Pac-12 stinks. They're awful.
Yeah.
They're going to get, like, what, 2, maybe 3 bids? Not that many. The Atlantic 10 this year is going to be a 1-bid league. The Missouri Valley is going to be a 1-bid league. The WCC is probably going to end up being a 1-bid league. How many teams are going to make it out of, like, the Mountain West? That's probably just going to be Nevada, unless somebody goes out and picks off Nevada in the conference tournament. So you have all these conferences that normally end up getting, you know, the A-10 is normally good for, what, 3 or 4 bids? They're probably going to only be one. Yeah. The American is usually good for 3 or 4 bids. They might get just like maybe 1, maybe 2 bids this year, depending on what Cincinnati and Houston end up doing. So those bids are going to have to come from somewhere. Somebody is going to have to go to the NCAA tournament. And if the Big Ten is doing all this work in non-conference play and their computer numbers are going to look so good, then them beating up on each other isn't really going to matter. Like, that's why. So like the Big 12, the reason they always get like 7, 8 teams in, is even teams with losing records, is because if you're 8-10, but 9 of those 10 losses came to teams that are like in the top 50 or the top 75 or whatever it is, if none of them count as bad losses, then, I mean, you're probably going to get in the tournament. Like, the committee has shown us that. So I'm fully on the bandwagon of saying I'm going to set the over-under at 8.5 for the number of teams from the Big Ten that get in, and I would take the over.
Interesting. Because it's going to be very interesting if, like, the bubble teams are Maryland and Minnesota. Because for all, like, the good stuff that the league has done this year in non-conference, it's mainly due to other teams. Like, Maryland's schedule is an abomination. And if they get in with, like, going 10-10, mainly because the league is just keeping them afloat, then it's going to make this 20-game schedule thing, like, look genius. And then everyone's going to do it anyway, but I think it will just accelerate the matter.
Yeah, and it's the same. It's like the exact opposite of what happened to Nebraska last year, right? Last year, Nebraska, all those wins they had in conference, none of them looked any good. Now you're almost going to be forced to be getting like 5 or 6 good wins in your league because you're going to win some games at home. It's just going to happen. Right. You're going to beat Iowa at home, and you're going to beat, I don't know, like Nebraska at home, and somebody has to win these games. There are going to be good wins around for everybody in the league, and I just think there are going to be enough teams to get those wins when compared to, like, nobody in the Pac-12, nobody is going to be getting good wins. Like, there aren't any elite teams in that league. I don't even think they have someone in the top 25 right now. Like, UCLA, I don't think is a top 25 team. Who's the best team in the Pac-12? UCLA, Arizona, Oregon, like,
I
Washington.
Don't know, man. I saw that UCLA team play in person, and it was terrible. They didn't look like they ever played a game together. I don't know. I mean, Stanford goes to overtime at Kansas. That's pretty good, but I have no idea. I can't even name one guy on Stanford.
They also lost by like 70 to North Carolina earlier this year. It was something. It wasn't 70, but it was something. So it's I don't know, man. But I really do think the Big Ten is going to get a lot of bids into the tournament. Brendan, I know you're probably almost to East Lansing now. I appreciate your time. If anybody is still listening to this, you can follow Brendan on Twitter at BFQuinn. It's not at BQQuinn. That's the guy from Impractical Jokers, and I accidentally tweeted at him about something once when I meant to tweet at you. I wonder if he actually saw that. But at BF Quinn on Twitter, and you can find his podcast anywhere that – where are you guys? iTunes, Spotify, all that
everywhere.
Good stuff?
All of them.
And it is called The Moving Screen. It has lots of insight on Michigan, lots of insight on Michigan State, and plenty of nuggets on the Big Ten in general. Brendan, I appreciate the time, man. Thank you.
Rob, thank you, my brother.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.